Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Let me introduce my very special guest. We're honored to have him. Scott Wingerter is a husband, father, teacher, and 12-year Air Force veteran. His first duty assignment was the 94th Intelligence Squadron at Fort Meade, Maryland, working at the National Security Agency for 8 years, conducting over 300 intelligence missions with the U-2 spy plane. In 2009, Scott received deployment orders to the Joint Interrogation and Briefing Center in Iraq and was in Iraq from August of 2009 to March of 2010. In 2011, Scott joined the Kansas Air National Guard, once again working with U-2 spy planes. Scott has a master's degree in U.S. history from Sam Houston State University. He is passionate about service and has served both his country and community his entire adult life. He's also the host of a successful podcast. Scott Wingerter, welcome to our program.
Hey, Bob, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I want to say a guy living in the what we call the reddest county in all of Texas, Montgomery County. I was a bit surprised to be on a radio show out in California, but I'm all for it. And I wanted to thank the people of California for giving us that great president, Ronald Reagan. So
yeah, well, they can't arrest your voice. You have to actually be here physically to get arrested for anything you say in California. So you should be okay.
Sounds great.
Now, I know you follow the news carefully, and I know you had some thoughts about Donald Trump's recent comments about abortion. However, something happened in the news yesterday that I'd first like to get your thoughts on. We were talking in the first segment about Israel and Hamas, but of course, the news as of last night is that Israel was attacked by Iran. My brother lives in the West Bank and told me 99% of the rockets and drones were taken out by the Iron Dome and other defenses. One of them they called David Slingshot. I love that name. But wanted to get your thoughts about that and about the Biden administration. It didn't take long. It was kind of like, okay, well, it stopped. It's over. So we don't want you to retaliate, which was no surprise. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, it's so funny to me. 2016, we had all of the actors after Trump won the election coming out and making that commercial, encouraging the delegates to the Electoral College, do the right thing. Don't vote for Trump. You have the power. If you vote for Trump and he's elected president, then we're going to get into all these wars and, you know, we're going to get into a war with Iran. And then in 2020, Biden's coming out and say, I'm really scared that if Trump's reelected, you know, he's pushing us towards a war with Iran. Well, it's so funny that he didn't follow the same sort of playbook that we've been playing throughout the 20th century, starting with like Theodore Roosevelt, speak softly, carry a big stick, throwing money into the defense of America, making sure that you have a strong military. If you're the toughest guy in the room and you don't have to say that you're the toughest guy in the room, nobody messes with you. And that, I think, encompasses both Reagan's foreign policy and Trump's foreign policy. That is not a way to articulate President Biden's foreign policy. I think President Biden has pretty much just telegraphed nothing but weakness on the foreign stage. This is why in 2014, Russia is able to invade the Crimean Peninsula and nothing happens. Trump comes in, it's crickets from Russia. It's crickets from China. They're not talking about, during the Trump administration, this idea of invading Taiwan. And all of the terror cells after Donald Trump basically eradicated ISIS, you see then that, oh, they're the big guy in the room, we better not mess with them. Biden walks in, what happens? Russia invades Ukraine. Hamas commits the worst terror attack in Israel's history. China's flexing on their ability to potentially invade Taiwan. And now all of a sudden, Iran is actually taking full responsibility, which is a kind of a new...
Well, and remember what Biden said to them back in October? He said, if you're thinking Iran of attacking Israel, I have just one word, don't. You can see the utter terror that put into them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't. Okay. So what if we do? Yeah. Well, we did last night.
Yeah.
And what's going to be our response?
No, there'll be nothing. We defended Israel, but there will be no preemptive attack against Iran. Israel would love to have one and maybe will have one, but then we will turn again. You've served in the military in such an honorable way, Scott. How do you feel about the fact that the big priority in the military these days is for soldiers to learn the correct pronouns?
Well, you know, it just doesn't go along with the culture of the United States military since 1775. You know, we've never shied away of taking on a fight, you know, even if it's against the big baddie. At the time, it was England. And we've always had that sort of, I would say, Spartan esprit de corps when it comes to facing down our military opponents. And to go woke, for lack of a better word, I think is a great disservice to our military. The military has to be a warrior culture. And when we're worried about what pronouns we're calling each other, that is not a cohesive defensive plan, in my estimation.
Plus, it's a lot of nonsense and stupidity, no matter what part of our culture we're in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the podcast that you have. I know it's over YouTube. Any other channels?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram. I'm on X, Twitter. I'm on Truth Social, all the major social medias. But my big one that I'm concentrating on right now is really Instagram and YouTube. You can find me at, if you search in YouTube, The Scott Wingerter Show. The reason that it's such an original name is I originally had a successful podcast on YouTube called Impolite Company, where we discuss all the things that you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. However, because of a trademark infringements, supposedly, YouTube banned my channel permanently. And
was that really the reason, or was it because of your subject matter and they were trying to censor you?
I suspect it was probably the latter, Bob, because I think they found out that I was a conservative and an intelligent individual, and that's dangerous.
You were making too much sense, Scott, and you were confusing people by using facts.
I had gotten just to 1,000 subscribers, which is what you need to do in order to get monetized. And then I go for a review process and then, oh, it's a trademark infringement, even though you can't
sure
trademark.
It is. Have you ever found the program that supposedly has this trademark?
Yes, yes. So it's an LLC out of Missouri that trademarked Impolite Company, but my show is Impolite Company with Scott Wingerter. I'm sure, as you know, you can't trademark a phrase.
Yeah, and in the publishing world, you can't even trademark the title of a book, so it sounds pretty fishy to me.
It's absurd on its face, but, you know, it is what it is, and that's okay. You know, I take
And is this mostly a news show? Is it mostly political commentary?
So my background as a historian, my favorite things to write about is intellectual history, which is the history of ideas, which is a really hard thing to track throughout history because, you know, how to get inside someone's head. But there are methods, and I love that idea of tracking really big ideas. I really enjoy legal history, and where I think all of that coincides, especially with love of political theory and philosophy, is the founding of the country. And so that's really my area of expertise, if you will. So I kind of bring all of those elements together in my show. I cover current events, I cover political theory, political thought, and I always sprinkle in an element of history because how could I not? I'm a historian. That's my thing.
Oh, that sounds great. I'm going to make sure I catch that really soon. And so you say Instagram is probably your biggest platform right now?
Instagram and YouTube, yeah. I mean, the show's literally a month old, and I already have about 60,000 views on YouTube. So
that's fantastic.
That's great. We're just going gangbusters on it. And so if your audience would like to help us go even more gangbuster, we'll take it.
Well, that sounds terrific. Okay, so there's probably all kinds of things on your radar tonight. I got your opinion of a few things. What is on your news radar this evening?
Well, I really liked what you said in the opening there. If I can jump into this, is
absolutely
one of my passions here. You said that Biden's not going to respect the Supreme Court in certain circumstances, but he does when it benefits him politically, right? And you made mention of the fact that the Supreme Court doesn't really have in Article 3 the enumerated power of this so-called judicial review.
Yeah, that's the biggest myth, that they're there to interpret. It's a practice that started with Marbury versus Madison. I know you're more the legal scholar. Of course, Marbury goes back almost to the beginning of our country, so it's been kind of grandfather clauseed, hasn't it?
It has. And, you know, and frankly, I don't know how pragmatically you get rid of it. Anytime you're discussing anything in philosophy, you have to first understand, are we talking from an ideological standpoint or are we talking from a pragmatic standpoint? So let's cover both very quickly here. Ideologically, if you read Article 3, I'll make a bet with your audience here. All right. If you can find me in Article 3 of the Constitution, the words judicial review or any indication that judicial review is actually a thing in the Constitution, I'll give you $1 million. And if you're wrong, you owe me nothing.
No, it was originally just supposed to be the highest court in the land if there were lawsuits, etc. It wasn't supposed to be putting the other two branches of government in check, correct?
That is correct, yeah. So if you go back and you look at it, the way that this went down was really a response to the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. John Adams signed this bill into law. And that is what pushed both James Madison and Thomas Jefferson to write the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And that demonstrates that at the time in 1798, that there was no such thing as judicial review. John Jay was still the Chief Justice. He was the original Chief Justice, of course, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers. And both Jefferson and Madison are articulating this idea that if a law, which the Alien Sedition Act was unconstitutional, if a law were to come into being that was unconstitutional, according to Madison and Jefferson, what you should do is you should have your state legislature basically pass a resolution saying, we think that this law is unconstitutional. And the Alien and Sedition Act, in particular, the sedition part, was frankly outright unconstitutional. It said that if you say anything bad about the President of the United States, then they can shut down your printing press and lock you up.
Oh, they must have been thought they were living under Biden 200 years ago.
Right? So, I mean, before the ink's even dry on the Constitution, we're running into this whole problem that we're seeing today of cancel culture and shutting down voices that you don't particularly like. So that was Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's idea that that's how you should handle this. Well, going forward then, as John Adams is literally leaving in the election of 1800, he loses re-election to Thomas Jefferson, and the Congress, which had been comprised primarily of Federalist congressmen, they're all kicked out of office and they're replaced by Democratic Republicans, of course, the party of Madison and Jefferson. And the Democratic Republicans are looking around and they're going, oh, man, we're in a tough spot here. We've just lost the entire government. And so the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court, but all other inferior courts, and you can find this in Article 1 of the Constitution, are brought into being by the Congress. And so what the Federalist Congress, the lame duck Congress in 1800 did, was they started creating all of these new judicial spots, and they stacked them full of Federalist judges in order to maintain control, at least over the judiciary. And then John Adams' Secretary of State at the time was John Marshall. And so the way that Marbury Madison came into being was, as Madison was sworn in as the next Secretary of State, John Marshall was sworn in as the new Chief Justice upon the retirement of John Jay. And so William Marbury, who was one of these Federalist judges that they packed the judiciary with, he didn't get his commission, because when James Madison walked into the Secretary of State's office, on his desk was sitting all of these commissions, and they hadn't delivered them to the newly appointed judges. And so Madison grabbed the stack of papers and promptly disposed of them into his trash can. And so William Marbury sued. What's really should have happened is, because literally John Marshall's signature was on William Marbury's commission, he should have recused himself. Any other judge would have recused himself for being a part of the whole case, but he did. And in the end, what he ended up doing in order to maintain that control over the judiciary was he established the idea of judicial review, and we've been stuck with it ever since. And so now, going to the pragmatic side, how do you get rid rid of that. Well, I don't know that we can.
Right. It's like maybe we wish they didn't have that power, but since they do, we still need to be concerned about who our president is and who he puts on the Supreme Court.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so my, you know, I'm just one man, but my opinion is this is one of those reasons that we really require, in my opinion, an Article 5 convention of the states, where the states themselves, and you can find this in Article 5, there's a second method by which we can propose constitutional amendments. And you call a convention of states, it takes two-thirds of the states in order to call a convention, and then anything that would come out of that convention in the form of a constitutional amendment would follow the same process. It would go to the several states, and if the state legislatures of three-fourths of the several states were to ratify that amendment that came out of that body, then it would become constitutional law at that point. And that's what's required here, in my view.
Well, I'd like to see their power rescinded, but at the very least, I'd like to see a convention that establishes that it is nine justices or an odd number of justices, with all this talk now from the Democrats about how they want to pack the court just to get their way, so that the court becomes nothing but a rubber stamp for Democrat policy.
Right. That's an extremely dangerous viewpoint. And the point of the court and having those lifelong appointments for the Supreme Court in particular is the idea that you're going to have that consistency and stability in the judicial branch. And so while you can't get rid of, I think at this point, it's too ingrained in our culture and our society and our body politic, you can't get rid of judicial review. It is an extra constitutional power, as I noted. However, it is a power that exists. And so the clear solution, in my view, is to have a check on that power the way that we do with anything else in our federal government.
Well, and the Constitution already provides for that check, but somehow we need to have a convention to reaffirm that or state it more clearly or something.
I would like to see the idea, and you can find this, I'm quoting, I'm one of those loyal backbenchers if anybody listens to Mark Levin.
Mark Levin.
So right out of the Liberty Amendments book, where he says that you can have a supermajority, maybe two-thirds, maybe three-fourths of the state legislatures can then overturn Supreme Court precedents. That's a pretty high mark, and I think that that would do us well.
It certainly would. And I understand that even in Marbury versus Madison, they actually ruled ultimately, first they chewed him out in an obligatory way, but they actually ruled with Jefferson. And yet Jefferson had the integrity and the consistency to say that he was still concerned with the amount of power the court had.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, rightfully so. There's a quote from Jefferson that shows, and of course, Jefferson was a lawyer before being a delegate to the Second Continental Congress and then ambassador of France, secretary of state.
Oh, you mean he was more than just a white slave owner? Jefferson actually had a resume of accomplishments?
Yes, absolutely. Jefferson is very impressive. At 10 years old, Jefferson could write both Greek and Latin at the same time. Latin with his left hand. And
yeah,
Greek with
I was
his
able to repeat a Leave It to Beaver episode when I was 10 years old.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was very, very impressive, man. But Jefferson, when referring to the judges, particularly the judges in England, he called them rats peeping out from underneath their powdered wigs. So he did not have a high opinion of judges.
Well, I know you did have some thoughts about Donald Trump's recent statements about abortion, and conservatives, whatever you may think about it, the alternative would be to put in somebody who wants no restrictions on abortion. So be really careful. Don't just pat yourselves on the back and say, I'm pro-life, I'm a conservative. But that doesn't mean we can't have opinions about what Trump did. How are you seeing this whole thing, Scott?
Well, I mean, so again, let's talk, are we talking pragmatically or are we talking ideologically?
Well, we can do both. Let's start ideologically and then go pragmatically.
Perfect. That's exactly what I was going to do. So the Declaration of Independence is the talk and the Constitution is the walk, if you will. It's an articulation of a 2,500-year-old idea that basically stems from ancient Greece, in particular Athens. And so what I like to ask my students is, we all say we have rights, but how many people out there can really define rights? Like, what I'm saying is, if you look up the term in the dictionary, what's it say? What's the definition? Don't give me an example like freedom of speech or freedom of religion. What is the definition? And the idea is this. It literally is right as opposed to wrong. Okay. So if you have right to life and I pull out a 45 and I shoot you and I murder you and I steal your life, I'm morally wrong for doing that. If you have a right to liberty and I kidnap you and chain you to a water heater in my basement or whatever, right? I'm morally wrong for doing that. Like, no one's going to say, oh, yeah, well, there he goes again. That's just what Scott does. He's always murdering people. Calm it down, Scott. No, everyone would be aghast if I murdered somebody, and rightfully so, because the definition, if you translate it into ancient Greek, the word is dikaiomata, and it means that which is morally just and correct. So it's literally right versus wrong. So if you have a right to life, let's say, I have a duty and obligation then not to murder you. And so that's how the whole system of natural law works. And so we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. Bam, there you go. That is what you have. That's the purpose of government. Government is designed to literally protect the rights of the citizens by the consent of the governed. So there is your argument for a nationwide ban on abortion, because everybody has a right to life, period, full stop. Now, let's shift to pragmatism. We have lost on the ballot every single time that this issue, now that Dobbs has been decided and Roe is tossed out, every single time that this ballot initiative has come up in states that we should win, like Kansas and Montana and Kentucky and most recently Ohio, the GOP, the conservatives, the Republicans, the pro-life community, however you want to describe it, we've gotten our butts kicked at the polls. And Trump's looking at that, and he knows that if he takes the traditional GOP conservative Republican stance on this issue, that he will get clobbered at the polls. Biden wants nothing more than to Trump take that particular traditional Republican stance.
Okay, Scott, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. My special guest, Scott Wingerter, you're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
I'd like to believe in Jesus, but the title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com. and BarnesandNoble.com.
We're joined tonight by Scott Wingerter, a historian and podcaster. Scott, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thanks so much, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so you were talking about Trump's comment about abortion, and ideally, those of us that are conservative would like to see the law of the land that you're not allowed to have an abortion. From a pragmatic point of view, it could cause us to lose the election. Go ahead and continue with that thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I was saying before the break, you know, when you look at states like Montana and Kansas and Kentucky and Ohio, red states consistently voting in presidential elections for the Republican candidate, what we're seeing is these states are codifying a right to abortion in their state constitutions. And that should make us pause, because what it is a reflection of is where our body politic is currently. And it should give us concern, grave concern, I would say, because we are no longer looking at this, in my estimation, in my opinion, in the correct way or right way. I just articulated before the break that human beings have a natural God-given right to life. And if we're not protecting that, which is the role of government, according to the Constitution, is to protect the rights of the people, we're not doing that in these states. And that's a problem. I think Trump's The Greek word's praxis, so practical wisdom, right? Think of praxis like this. If I were to take you to Big Ben, the, you know, large clock tower in London, right? And I said, okay, Bob, you got 30 seconds to look at all the cogs and gears and springs moving inside this clock tower. Okay, you got it. And then I hit a button and the whole thing falls apart. And I'm like, all right, put it back together so that the clock ticks. Could you do that? Probably not, right? But you're going to give it the old college try, right? That's the analogy of praxis. Making practically wise decisions on the spot, off the cuff, is a difficult thing for anybody to do. And I do think that Trump is making a prudent decision, a practical decision in our current political environment, backing up the decision of the Dobbs case, saying, well, it's up to the states. What I have a problem with is it's strikingly similar. I see a lot of correlation here. If you study the 1850s, the political situation that we found ourselves as a country in the 1850s, I know California had just become a state, where what are we going to do with all of these new territories that we gained from Mexico? Are we going to allow slavery to exist inside of these new territories? That was the big issue of the day. And when you look at slavery, I think it's a pretty good analogy for the idea of abortion here. When you study the language at the time, they referred to slavery as the peculiar institution of slavery. And what makes it peculiar is you have to understand the scope of law, right? At the very top, you have on the scope, it goes from the universal to the particular. So at the very top, at the most universal, one-size-fits-all approach, you have natural law. And that's what we're talking about, the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, etc. Those are universal across the board. If you're a human being and you have a face, then you have these natural rights because you're created in the image of God and God has endowed you with these rights. And it's a good thing, even if you're an atheist, you should be on board with this idea because in theory, God is the highest authority in the universe and he gave you these rights. And so no lesser authority, whether it's one man or a group of men, can take them away from you. Okay, so that is natural law. Slavery, on the other hand, and in this case, abortion, is a particular law. It's passed through what's referred to as positive law. So it's the same idea that when you go out on the street outside your house, the speed limit's probably like, what, 25 miles an hour. But on the highway, it might be 55, it might be 65, it might be 70, whatever. That's positive law, right? And it's particular. So you have this example, which should never actually occur, where positive law actually trumps natural law. In the case of slavery, you're saying, all right, well, this person who's made in the image of God and is endowed by God with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yeah, they don't get that because they're actually my property. And so therefore, I control them. And so it's a case where positive law trumps natural law, and that should never really happen. In the instance of abortion, what we're doing is we're robbing a human being of their life because of the decision of a mother. I'm going to reference a case out of California about 20 years old. If everybody could remember the case of Scott Peterson, who I...
Oh, the guy that murdered his wife.
Exactly. And what was he incarcerated for? Double homicide.
That's right, because when a woman wants to keep the child, they'll call it a homicide if something happens. When she doesn't want to keep it, then they change the name to fetus, and they play all these word games that come right out of George Orwell.
Exactly, but you can't have a consistent law system that recognizes those sort of loopholes, if you will. In other words, our law shouldn't depict whether or not a person is alive dependent upon or contingent upon whether or not the mother intends to keep it. So if Lacey Peterson 20 years ago wanted to go get an abortion in California, well, then she could do that because that was her so-called right. But because she didn't do that and Scott Peterson murdered her and by proxy their child, then he slapped with double homicide. That is inconsistent and the law should not be inconsistent like that.
It is inconsistent. It's an inconsistency that very few people ever stop to take the time to notice.
Right. And so while I understand that abortion is a peculiar institution in America these days, I think the Dobbs decision, I applauded it. It was a great battle that the pro-life side won. We now have 51 battles, the states plus DC, that we have to take part in. And Trump recognizes sort of this political Overton window that he's in, that it's just not really possible for him to take the traditional stance that maybe a GOP nominee for president would be able to take. But that should give everybody pause, because when you look back all the way, I mean, I'm 41 years old, so when I was born, Ronald Reagan was president. So Reagan held the position that we shouldn't have abortion. George H.W. Bush, 1988, held that position. Bob Dole held that position in 1996. George W. Bush held that position in 2000. John McCain held that position in 2008. Mitt Romney held that position in 2012. Trump in 2016 and in 2020 held that position. And now in 2024, he's taken the soft position.
Well, now, did he really change his position, or is he simply saying, look, it's up to the states, and whatever my position is, I'm not trying to federalize it?
I think you have to say that he has changed his position, if you're going to be intellectually honest, because when you look at those rhetoric from 2016 and 2020, his position was that abortions are bad. Gone are the days of even Democrats saying that it should be safe, rare, and whatever it is that they used to say.
Safe, rare, and legal. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. But he's saying, no, it's up to the states now. But that's because he recognizes, because he has his thumb on the pulse of the body politic, what he has to say in order to get elected. And from a pragmatic standpoint, I understand that. Because if it's a choice between Trump or Biden, who do I want to win? Well, I want Trump.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I may be disappointed in Trump's rhetoric, but to try to decide between Trump or Biden, that folks, there should be nothing to even think about, because would it be safe to say, Scott, that we just got to fight this one battle at a time? I'm thinking back, you brought up slavery. I'm thinking about slavery when the Declaration of Independence was formed and then later the Constitution. There were originally anti-slavery clauses in there. The South said, we will not go along with it. You will not have a revolution. You will not have a Constitution at all. And the people in the North and the abolitionists finally said, okay, first let's get our country, then we'll worry about slavery. Can that idea be a template for how we deal with abortion right now?
I think it has to be. I think you're right. I think it absolutely has to be. And so just like I gave you my opinion on judicial review, and I said, all right, this is a problem, I also gave you a solution, right? And so here's my solution for the abortion issue. Conservatives, we've got to do a better job at reaching the culture and changing the culture, because we've lost the culture. I mean, think about what we've lost. We've ceded K through 12 education in the public school. We've ceded the academy, as you've noted earlier in your show. We ceded the arts and the sciences as well. We've ceded the news media. We've ceded Hollywood and film and all of these things. It makes you wonder, we call ourselves conservative, what exactly are we conserving if we are not conserving our culture? We have to get back into the culture. And so I'm excited to share with your audience that I'm an executive producer with a film company called Sixpence Productions. And we have a show right now. It's a supernatural thriller that takes on the issue of abortion in it. In the Shadow of High Places. And you can find us at Sixpence, spelled out SIXPENCE.pro.com. We have our pitch deck up there. I'm excited to say we have officially attached Kevin Sorbo and his son as a character in the show. Kevin Sorbo is going to play a gentleman in his 60s. And his son, Braden, who's also officially attached, will be playing the same character, but the character's name's Jack. So Braden will be playing Jack in Vietnam in 1968. So it's great because he looks just like his dad. But the idea here is we have the theme of life and death. And so we're comparing life and death sort of in that warfare situation that a young man would find himself in Vietnam in 1968. And then we're taking that and we're talking about it in terms of what does abortion look like? Because abortion is literally an issue of life and death as well. And so we're going to explore that, and we're going to explore the theological and supernatural. We got angels, we got demons going on all in the background as well. And it's just a really fascinating thing that we're trying to do here, because we recognize the importance of winning back the culture. I can't just take this and do what Hollywood's done with everything that they've produced for the last 10 years. Hollywood's beating you over the head with this woke club. If you put your message before you put the story, then it doesn't work. It's the same thing. So we could try that as conservatives, where we just have this conservative message that we're beating you over the head with. But I don't think that that's really effective. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to enter into a national dialogue about this abortion issue, because a lot of people have either already made up their minds about it, or they're on the fence and are uncomfortable talking about or thinking about it. And we need to enter into an actual civil dialogue about these life and death issues, because I think it really reflects on the soul of our country. And I really feel like if we can do that, I think we can really win the argument, because there's really no argument to be had when it comes to what is considered life and how important that right to life is. It's literally about who we are as a people and who we are as a nation.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful project. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, we're currently in the pre-production for it, and we're fundraising. We're trying to make a 90-second trailer right now, and that's going to cost us about $8,000 at the low end. And if someone's really excited about hearing this idea and you want to participate and you want to help us out, you could help us out by going to, we have a GiveSendGo account for the show. So if you go to givesendgo.com/highplaces, there's an opportunity for you there. You know, $5, $10. $25, $50, whatever you feel called to give, we certainly appreciate it. We have a team here at Sixpence that has decades of experience in film, and we're going to create a HBO-style worthy TV show that I think is going to be able to capture people's imagination and really cause them to think. At the end of the day, I'm a classicist. I've been a headmaster of a Christian classical school for the last 2 years. My wife and I run this classical school here in Montgomery County, Texas. And so I'm going to be directing this as well. And so I have all of these ideas that have permeated in my mind throughout the Western tradition that I always want to bring into any work of literature that I would be working on. And I consider film a piece of literature, because yeah, you have moving pictures, but it's still conveying these ideas and messages that you can get out of a book like the Iliad or the Odyssey or the Aeneid, right? And so that's really where my heart is on this. And so if you want to come along board and help us out, we'd certainly be grateful and appreciative. I know the economy's tough right now. Even if you could just pray for the success of our project, that would be fantastic as well. And we wouldn't certainly turn that down.
Okay, we only have about 1 minute left. Very quickly, the future of our country if Joe Biden wins again.
If Joe Biden,
not that I think he won the first time, but wins again in quotes.
You're right. If Joe Biden wins again, he's going to take it as a nod that everybody approves of what he's been doing, and he's going to continue to march leftward, which will be bad for our country because it's going against the very principles of the founding of our country. Our rights will be minimized and in jeopardy, and I really think that it's going to be very difficult for us to recover the country that I grew up in, you know, most of your audience grew up in as well. And I would hate to see that happen.
Well, on that note, hopefully it won't happen that way. But on that note, Scott, wonderful having you on the show. I hope you'll join us again.
I will be happy to come on anytime you want me on.
All right. You're a great guy. I was honored to meet you. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.